It's Monday, November 20th, 2006, and you're listening to episode 28 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 53 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and with me on the mics is Chad.
Hi.
Adam.
Hey.
And Tex.
Hello.
Tex is actually my older brother who is back visiting from Seattle. Tex works for Microsoft on the Xbox Live team. What is your exact role?
He fetches coffee when they ask.
Oh.
And the coffee has to return hot, otherwise they're angry.
So they hired this engineer from Rolla, and they're like, hot. Hot. And he's like,
not cold.
Okay.
Exclamation point, cold.
So we have established...
Wow. Death looks from Tex. Excellent.
I just didn't have anything useful to add to the conversation.
Neither did we, but we added it anyway.
Well, to answer Dan's question so I don't make him segue back into it...
It should be like a show motto. I had nothing useful to add to the conversation, but I did anyway. Okay. Please, Tex, what is it you actually do for Xbox
Live? Well, I wasn't going to force you to have to re-segue there.
Okay.
I'm a shift lead with Xbox Live Operations. So I'm part of a team that monitors the health of Xbox Live 24/7/365.
Okay.
So, what shift do you work?
Currently graveyard, but I'm transitioning to days.
Are you really?
Yes,
great.
I am.
We'll see you more on WoW.
All right. Now, since Tex has come here to visit us, he has brought with us some prizes from Xbox that we are going to be giving away over the next four shows. And we're going to tell you in a minute here how you can win those. Now, leading up to this, I first want to send a shout out to High Moon Press, who has a magazine called Targum. And by the way, High Moon Press is a kind of a smaller independent press role-playing game creator. They have a role-playing game that I think is kind of a neat concept called Testament, which is set in the like Old Testament biblical period, Babylon and Assyria and Israel and all that. And they have a magazine for it called Targum, T-A-R-G-U-M, and they're actually running a full-page ad for Fear the Boot. Yeah, next month or something like that. So big thanks to Dan Perez over there and all the guys at High Moon. And now we have a contest of our own to work out before we get into Tex's new contest for us. We had a call put out to all the artists that listened to the show several weeks ago to give us their rendition of the great Baron von Badass.
The good Baron.
And for those of you that are just now picking the show up for the first time, Baron von Badass was actually just some phrase that was uttered in passing that for whatever reason the listeners found amusing, and so we're just running with it a little bit. And I gotta say...
A little bit. I'm wearing the t-shirt, man. I can't wait.
I was impressed, because when I put this out, I figured we'll get like one entry. I didn't think really anyone would follow the call on this one. Mm-hmm. But I have to say that not only did we get a bunch of entries, but they were really good entries.
Fantastic.
And I'm not just saying that to be polite or to be a statesman, as someone on the forums called me. That really is the honest truth, that there are some great entries in there. And if we had to kick one of them out, I would have no problem taking any other one in there.
This is going to sound cheesy. I really mean this. I really wish that we could take each of the entries we got and put them all on a t-shirt.
Right,
I like
them
all.
Cheesy.
It does sound cheesy. It sounds like I'm pandering, but I really mean it. I really liked all the entries.
Well, I routinely listen to your episodes, and I remember when you first announced it, I was thinking to myself, oh great, they're going to get some 16 color stuff done in MS Paint.
No, we got one of those.
I submitted that one.
Right, but you're just qualified.
It was brilliant. It even looked like you with blonde hair. That was the best part. You had the goatee and everything.
I didn't want to say it was me, but
we all knew.
All right. Yes, you do have some talented artists among your listeners.
Yeah, some of them are professional artists. Yes. And I don't just mean like they get paid commissions for us. I mean, some of them have actually worked for like role-playing games. They've done art in major role-playing games. Like, I believe one of them actually did art, I believe, for Hero System or Champions.
One of them did work on actually several systems and did maps and whatnot. I don't know. Yeah, again, we don't have the forums open in front of us where he lists his work.
All right, but unfortunately, as contests like this go, there can only be one winner, so we have to pick somebody. Therefore, with no further ado, we have chosen Mr. Keith Curtis. We have selected your rendition of Baron von Badass as our winner. So Excellent. We are going to be sending you a Geek Label card. We're also going to be working with Geek Label to get this turned into a t-shirt. And when it does, we will send you on our dime, in addition to that Geek Label gift certificate, a free copy of this shirt to thank you for your entry. A big thanks to all you guys that entered. I mean, honestly, they were really some great entries. We were really pleased with how this turned out. So big thanks to all of you, but yes, we had to pick one winner, so we chose Keith Curtis for this. Now, let's get on to Texas Contest. All right, Tex, let's talk about, first of all, what you brought us, and then we're going to talk about how we're giving it away.
Okay. Well, actually, I have an assortment of prizes. One of them is a neon Xbox Live sign that is something like you would see in a gaming store's window shop.
Yeah, and this isn't, you don't mean neon colored. I mean neon as in you plug it in and it lights up.
It's full of neon gas and it glows when you plug it in.
Right.
And how big is this? It's about the size of...
It's about the size of a shoebox.
It's about 12 inches, say 18 inches wide by...
Something like that.
Yeah, 6 inches tall. Okay.
I also have a Xbox 360 hat, and I have my Xbox 360 Live Services Group Stadium Blanket from the 2006 Microsoft company meeting.
It's unused, right?
Unused.
Yeah, this is not his dirty old blanket.
No.
It's unused.
Yeah, but 18 months it was use. In the presence of you know, Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer.
They gave speeches. It still glows.
Yes.
You can see the sweat stains from Ballmer.
I also have some video games.
He polished his head.
So, okay, he also has some video. Go ahead and read off. What are three games?
These are all brand new games. They all still have the security seal on the box.
And these are all for Xbox 360.
Yes.
And by the way, all this stuff is new. None of this stuff has been used. This is all brand new stuff.
Even my blanket is new.
Even the blanket is new.
Except for the Steve Ballmer sweat stains.
No, I never used
the panties rolled up in it he doesn't know anything about.
Yes.
Nor does his wife.
Whoa! okay, so we have Need for Speed Most Wanted.
Okay.
We also have Burnout Revenge. And we have Xbox Live Arcade Unplugged, which is actually 6 mini Xbox Live Arcade games.
And you said these are the full versions, not the demos, right?
That's correct. These are full versions, not demos. We have Bejeweled, Geometry Wars, Wick Fable of Souls, Backgammon, Outpost Koloki, and Texas Hold'em.
Oh, Hold'em and Bejeweled.
Well, Outpost Koloki is actually my favorite Xbox Live Arcade game, and although Stryker was quite notorious for his high position on the Geometry Wars leaderboards, I believe I was actually the last Microsoft employee to still hold a number one spot on a worldwide leaderboard, which was in Outpost Koloki, although I have since been unseated.
Who is Stryker?
Stryker is one of our developers who works on Xbox Live Code. And he's extremely good at Geometry Wars, and for a while he held the number one spot on the Geometry Wars leaderboards, although he has also since been unseated.
Okay.
So Jay Allard just doesn't say, I feel like being number one in this game today, and then magically he just kind of pops up to number one? Doesn't
Don't
work
question
like that?
The programmers.
No. And if he does, they're not telling anyone. Stryker actually is Bill Gates. Here's how we're going to give these away. And by the way, this is still going to be an episode about role-playing games. We're just pausing here for a minute on Xbox because
20
of
minutes of business.
Well, I'm giving free stuff, so.
Yeah, he's giving free stuff away.
And you know what? Everybody loves free stuff.
And also, we got to talk a little about Xbox because this show actually is being linked off of Xbox.com. So we need to give a big welcome to all the Xbox folks that are coming over here. For those of you that aren't real familiar with the show, we don't normally talk a whole lot about video games. This is a tabletop role-playing game show. D&D, things like that. Hopefully you guys, you know, stop by, enter for the prizes, and then actually stick around and stay with us for a while and see if you like the show.
We'd love to have you.
So here's how we're giving these away. It's going to be real easy. All you have to do is go to feartheboot.com/contest. Feartheboot.com/contest. We will also put a link on the top little menu bar of our site where it says like home and links and all that. We will put a little contest link up there. You click it, there's going to be a little form. All you got to do is type on it, a little bit of contact information, send it to me. Once a week, we are going to pull one winner out of that. At the end of that week, we're going to give a winner. I am then going to wipe out all the entries. So if you want to re-enter, you got to come back the following week and enter again. We'll draw you again. We are going to group these prizes into four groups. The three games will stand alone. And then in that fourth group, we are going to put the hat, the blanket, and the neon sign as one big package because, quite frankly, I don't feel right giving someone just a hat as a prize. So we are going to...
I love hats.
Or more accurately, he doesn't feel good about paying the shipping cost for just a hat.
No, I really would. I'd feel like hey, you know, the guy before you got Need for Speed, you get a hat. So
nice.
I don't feel right about that. So we're going to put the hat, the blanket, and the neon sign together in one prize group. So four prizes, four weeks. What we are going to do, we record these shows on Saturdays. So this coming Saturday, November 25th, around noon Central Time, we are going to close off the entries. We're going to look them over. We're going to pick use a program to generate a random number, and we are going to pick one entry at random. That person will be contacted, and they will get to pick out of the bunch of prizes that are left which prize they want. They can pick any of the four. The only restriction we're putting on this is we are going to ask you for your Xbox gamer card tag, and we'll have instructions on the form about how you get that to us. If you want the three games, we want to know you actually have an Xbox 360. You're not just going to take the games and put them on eBay. So send us your gamer card to demonstrate that you have an Xbox Live account you actually use. Try to have about, I don't know, 500 gamer points, just some amount of gamer points to show you use it. If you do not have a gamer tag, you're one of our normal listeners who's a big role-playing buff, you don't even own an Xbox, you don't need to send one in, but if you win, we will only allow you to select for that final prize group, the hat, the blanket, the neon sign, just because, like I said, we want to know if we're sending you a 360 game, you're actually going to be able to do something with it, mm-hmm. not just put it up on eBay or take it and trade it in for pornography or whatever you would trade it in for your local gaming store.
I approve of pornography, but not trading in the game for it.
Specifically furry pornography.
Yes. You know, I was resisting that segue.
Oh, no, we don't at all. So, Adam, how's that going? How much furry pornography do you have right now?
You know, Gmail gives you like 2.5 gig. I don't want to talk about it.
He's had to open his second Gmail account.
I had to re-forward my Fear the Buddha address to another Gmail account just to catch the massive shloads of...
You know, I even tried to take the high road there to make them look, you know, a little juvenile for pursuing the furry porn, but that really didn't slow them down.
Dan and I don't pursue the furry porn. That's Adam's thing. We don't judge him.
We don't judge him. Yes.
They don't pursue the high road either. They pursue the old road.
Well, you know,
middle-aged men have their fun doing whatever it is that they do.
If you look at the tagline for our show, it says an irreverent roundtable discussion, not a mature roundtable discussion.
This is true.
This is why NPR has refused to pick the show up.
Yeah. So, besides the fact that they've never heard of us.
Now, while we're needling Adam, we have a question for you. Actually,
here it comes.
We've had hours to think of the answer.
Mick, over from the Harping Monkey podcast, has a question for you that we actually have for you as well. When in this show, we talk, of course, about role-playing games, but when we mention the higher points of role-playing about naming your characters, getting into character, all that kind of stuff, you always recoil at that. Now, on the flip side, you have also certainly shown disgust for hack and slash, that sort of stuff type of role-playing, the ROLL role-playing.
Yeah. So it's obvious you're not into dungeon crawls and don't want any of that role-playing to get in the way of it.
So why do you play RPGs?
Because you have demonstrated that
you love the art, but you like hate everything about it.
I just like talking about subjects like this. I'd like to consider myself and our group of friends the most public and the most private person in the group. When I was a young man, as many of the people on this podcast, I think with the exception of Chad, I had the aspiration of becoming a writer.
You said However, ass.
Actually, I never aspired to be a writer.
I was referring to more the regular host.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I don't know you, though. Actually, I met you tonight.
Dice aspired to make lots of money working with computers, and his dream has come true. So,
well, yeah, jerk.
Actually, yeah, pretty much since the age of 6, I aspired to be, like, an electrical engineer.
Congratulations for realizing your dream while we get to suffer.
Anyway, back to my story. I got up to about, I don't know, early teens when I realized that I have no creative talent whatsoever. So I flushed this dream and got rid of it and abandoned it. And I don't talk about it because I don't like to talk about it. I think that role-playing is a way that I can exercise the creative muscles that I don't have in a sandbox that somebody else creates, which is why I enjoy doing it.
So why are you running a game? This is a new question.
Dead silence.
Listen, I had like 3 hours to come up with an answer to that one. It was a crappy answer.
Well, maybe we'll save that one for next week.
I wouldn't
we'll
call
give
it
a
crappy answer. I would call it a mediocre answer. It definitely wasn't a good answer, but it wasn't a crappy answer.
You know that
well,
podcast.
What did you want for good answer?
You know, some striking piece of logic that would just cut through it all and say, no, you've missed it. There's some third thing you can get out of role-playing games, and that's what I do it for.
Yeah, that is it.
Yeah.
I do it for the creativity.
But isn't really the character depth and all that really part of the creativity? I guess that's what I'm having trouble separating.
He puts a lot of depth in his character.
He just doesn't play
He doesn't bring it out.
I understand.
A lot of things are going on in his head in the game.
Well, yeah, I think there's a difference between designing a fine suit of clothes and then putting the clothes on.
Right. You should see the narratives I write. When we played in Chad game, I always write out the narratives of what
the
games
that's
are.
Fair enough.
Mm-hmm. And when I can go back and reread them, and the games, as we played them, have very little to do with the narrative.
Right. And we've talked before about how Adam and I used to work together in the grocery store, and I would go back to his department, and we would talk through and past our breaks about these things. And he would get really deep. We wouldn't role play in the department, but damn near to it. We just these really deep discussions we would have on his character and his part and aspect of the game, and then his feelings on the game and such. It's actually something that I really miss about role playing. Is that the
so really what Adam's lacking is we just have to find some way to kind of break this fourth wall between his mind and the game.
Yeah, just wait until you start playing in my game.
Now
we'll see.
Question though. Do the people who game master tend to create worlds but not necessarily to role play them, actually act them out?
And Dawn.
Yeah.
Actually, Dawn does that.
Because you asked why he wanted to run a game, and I was thinking that running a game is actually, depending on how you narrate the game, could be a wonderful way for you to be very creative in creating the world, but not actually act out a character.
Yeah, to create the setting and the story for the other characters to do the acting.
Right,
part
but
of
then
it.
You yourself wouldn't actually have to kind of engage in extemporaneous theater.
Yeah.
I like theater.
That's another thing,
you love theater,
but
you
hate
theater.
You know what? Alina and I went out to lunch the other day, and we were talking about some Shakespearean play I've never heard of. And then I'm like, you know what? We should put on a Fear the Boot Hamlet. We should do it. I would totally be into it. And I got all excited about putting together this amateur theater company. And then my laziness kind of washed in and then decided.
Saved by his laziness.
Indeed.
All right, so let's move from one harebrained idea to the next.
Excellent.
Over the next several months, we are going to be doing a series on Fear the Boot about game design. We, for a while, talked about how we wanted to do some episodes on what, in our mind, would go into actually creating a good game system and setting. And mostly, throughout the history of this show, we have always talked about the best practices for executing an existing game. How to sit down to write good campaigns, to make good characters, how to handle problems with your players, to work through plots as you're GMing. But we have not really gotten into this, so we want to set aside the next several months to walk through this in a pretty good amount of detail. Now, before we dig into the actual subject matter at hand, I want to set some limitations on what this series is and is not. What this series is step-by-step advice on how to create what I'm calling a full product. And even if you don't intend to sell this, we are going to walk you through creating setting and rules as if this was going to be a standalone book or box set for a brand new role-playing game. If your interest is in creating, let's say, a new setting for the D20 system, great stuff, and you will get some information out of the series that will be useful to you, but that's not exactly what we're going after. And specifically, if world creation is what you're after, there are shows that have done long, long series on this that go far deeper than we're going to go. One example is if you go over to harpingmonkey.com on their show called The Roundtable, they did a whole long series on this, which actually we did one episode of.
Yeah, we did one episode.
During the whole Shake and Not Stirred thing. So you might want to check that out. Now, what this show is not is we are not going to be trying to create a breakthrough game. I kind of had this hankering in the back of my head at some point in my life to re-envision role-playing to a system that works different than the standard template of attributes and skills and you shoot the dice and whatever. And there are games out there that already kind of go for that, like Amber Diceless.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to do that because doing a breakthrough, even if it's the best thing ever created, it really doesn't help you at home to reproduce.
Right.
It's not showing you how to do it yourself.
We can go an entire episode on concepts of what would be good innovation, bad innovation, but couldn't really apply it to this or this game. It would be a completely separate entity, I think.
Now, Chad, you wanted us to mention this is not going to be a follow-along.
Right. Don't think of this as like something you'd see on Channel 9, like a Tim Bob Ross sort of you know, we're going to paint this stroke, and at home, you know, when I'm painting this little bird, you paint this little bird. It isn't going to be like that. It isn't going to be like, okay, today we're going to make a character sheet for the game, so you guys at home make a character sheet for your game that you're making, that you're following along with us. You won't be able to keep up. We have already made the game. The game already exists. We are just expanding on it and then presenting it to you guys and to kind of guide you if you do plan on making your own game from the ground up. So just a little FYI, right. You know, don't try and follow along with us step by step.
Yes. What we are actually working through is we have taken a homegrown system that we have played in the past, and we are going to walk through the process of how we would create this game and kind of what went into our thought process as we created this game. And the last time we played this was actually a couple of years ago. So in a sense, we are recreating the game with some new standards we've come up with personally since then. And we are going to release this in a step-by-step as we go through the creation process. So what you are going to see is a resurrection of the resources section of our site. So if you go to feartheboot.com, there's a link along the top for resources. Expect to see new documents appearing there. For example, one of the things we're going to talk about today is gaming math and concept design. So we are going to put up some documents there related to the topics we're talking about, and we are going to, over time, start tying those into our homegrown game. And by the time this series is over, it is going to be fairly minimalist. We're not going to dump a 200-page manual on you guys.
At least not yet.
Not yet. But we are going to release a very minimal role-playing game. But it will be complete. Yeah. You could play it this way. It's not real fleshed out, but you will have enough to play it.
Now, and that brings me to a question I have for you. The question I have is, how are we going to present our game in sections? Obviously, we have the rules system. We're going to polish them up a little bit. And obviously, we're not going to sit here and read verbatim out of our rules. Are we going to put the rules up, or is it something we're going to... Okay, we're going to put
them
up.
I'm a firm believer in the following. The podcast and the resources are not going to directly overlap, because you can read for yourself. There's no point in me reading to you the point-by-point rules or explaining the point-by-point history. If you care, go to the resources section on feartheboot.com, download them, and read them. Similarly, I am not on the documents going to recreate all the thoughts and all the outlines we've said in the show. Mm-hmm. If you really care, download the episode and listen to it.
Well, I think what you're separating is what you decided from why you decided it.
Exactly. Right. What is going to be in the resource section is primarily what we decided.
The outcome.
We may put some stuff in there, like we're going to put some of Tex's number charts in there, just because I can't explain those over the microphones real well. But for the most part, we're putting outcome there. If you want to know how we arrived at it or why we made these choices, that's what the podcast is for. I think it's insulting to the audience and a waste of our time to reproduce the same material in two different mediums.
And as a third option, too, because, again, we want the community to interact with this and we want people's feedback, I'm going to create a thread on our forums, and you know, we'll put up announcements and links there on stickies so that people have access to the thing, and then also... You know, people can give us feedback and their ideas.
All right, let's go ahead and talk about where we begin with this.
I think we should begin with a name. People are going to want to be able to call this something. I don't want people to call it the FTB role-playing game or the Fear the Boot
system. I want to know how to kill things.
I bet you
do. We
need
to start there.
You stab them. Roll for that.
Kill more monsters. Get better loot.
What a great name. What's the acronym for that?
Kill more monsters. Get better loot.
K-M-M-G-B-L.
Kim Gibble.
Kim Gibble. Yes.
You know what's sad is I'm actually basing this off of a banner ad for D&D.
Please.
Okay. I'm not making that
gross.
Up.
Hold on.
It's a new book. Now, what does it add to the game? Not deeper characters. Not better worlds. How you can build more powerful characters to kill bigger monsters and get more loot.
I have one thing to say. If hating that concept makes me elitist, then I'm an elitist. That is horrible.
And yet you play WoW.
Yes, I do. Because it's automated.
Oh, Jesus.
The name of the game that we are going to be creating is Skies of Glass. And we typically abbreviate to SOG. So if you hear us say SOG, we're talking about Skies of Glass. And the name is actually...
Let's
come back to that.
Let's save that when we get into like the game history or developing a background.
The name does have a meaning to the game, but we will come back to that. All right, so let's talk about what I see as the number one step in designing a game, which is conceptualization. This is not going into any detail on the game, This is simply trying to set the framework of what it is you hope to accomplish as you're creating this game.
Are you talking about a good old-fashioned brainstorming session with your team?
Yeah, and something perhaps even a little bit more organized than that. This is going to have a slight hint. This is going to have a dash of organizational psychology to it. Which,
gross.
Ooh, I know.
A sprinkling.
I even die a little bit inside when I say that. But the first step that I would suggest when you are creating a game is set some kind of an objective. Mm. Just simply put, what is it you're trying to do here? Are you trying to create a role-playing game that spins off of a movie you saw? Are you trying to create something that's meant purely for internal consumption to fill a niche?
Are you trying to set the record for the world's longest dungeon crawl?
Are you trying to sell it? Even trying to sell it's another good question.
Release it on the internet.
For example, one of my personal favorite homegrown games, which is not Skies of Glass, and maybe someday we'll get into this one, was created when we decided, you know what, we really want some kind of big, epic sci-fi game that has a certain feel to it, and we didn't have one. So we created a system out of that and created a whole game for that, a setting for that, which I hope eventually to do something with. In this case, what this came out of was we were sitting around playing the old Wasteland video game on an Apple IIe we had dug up out of Dawn's basement.
Yep. It was her old computer.
This is disgusting.
This is wonderful.
Have you ever played this game, Wasteland?
No.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Man.
Great Dude, game.
Apples?
But you also could play it on IBM. There was an x86 version of it. But we were sitting around playing Wasteland and just talking about how much we'd love the whole post-nuke genre and such. Someone said, you know what? We should create our own post-nuke game that is catered and aligned to our specific tastes.
Now, what you said, it sounds very intelligent. I think the actual conversation went something along the lines of, dude, we should role-play Wasteland! Yes!
Not quite, but it was somewhere between the two.
Yeah.
It was somewhere between the two. So in this case, we wanted to create a post-nuclear game. Originally, it was for internal consumption only, but now, because we're releasing it to the world, we have to change some things so that polish it up a bit, change the rules around a little bit so this is better for broad public consumption. When you are conceptualizing the game, I would also recommend picking something you love, because simple matter of fact is to develop this game is going to take a lot of thought, a lot of time, a lot of writing. Be sure it's something you love, because if you don't love it, you're going to get sick of this report. Common sense thing, but think about that. I remember as a young lad going down to the offices of MechForce North America, which was a fan magazine for Battletech, and hearing some words out of the mouth of one of the guys down there, which really was a great epiphany at the time, which is he said, you know, sitting here surrounded by these things all day, eventually you get really sick of these big robots.
You are in the wrong business, sir.
So pick something you love. I would also recommend picking something developable. I think there have been role-playing games out there that maybe have a great concept, but the problem you have is role-playing games are not built for one story. Mm-hmm. They are built for many stories and many characters. I remember looking at the Robotech role-playing game, and I really had to struggle to come up with anything to do with the game because the major story has already been told.
Right.
And so it just was kind of one of those things like, well, what's going on over here? Well, nobody knows. You have to write your own material. The role-playing game will not tell you because it doesn't know either.
Yeah.
So be sure that you are creating a world that really does allow for a great many plots and characters and things to occur in it.
And you want one that does have an overall overarching story, too, because you just don't want to create a setting that has a land and a map and people populating it, and everybody is in this sort of stasis. Again, you don't want people who just spring up from the earth and they're there. You want the whole world to have an overall arcing plot, or point, really. Also, I'll say something on a practical level, too. Make sure you have plenty of free time, because this is going to cause it takes work. It took us effort when we were doing it way back when. We had to cut time out of our even then free schedules. Nowadays, I think it would be really hard to do something like this, but doable, very doable, with jobs and kids and all that sort of stuff. And two, make sure that your spouse or significant other, even if they're not involved in the creation of this project, make sure they're supportive. Make sure that if you're sitting there writing, typing on your keyboard, they're not blasting the music. They understand. They understand that you need to take time to do this, to make this. Or even just to give moral support.
Yeah, and of course, some of this is based on intention, because if you're 16 years old and making this for you and your buddies to play, you probably have tons of free time. Yep. And don't,
just like we did.
Yeah, just like we did back then, as opposed to sitting here now at 30, mm-hmm. married and having a job and all these other things going on. You really have to think about that. And of course, also, mm-hmm. the game we're making is for external consumption. Yeah. So it has to be polished. We can't put out something. I mean, yeah, we have to accept that nothing's perfect on the first pass. Version 2 of this game ideally will be better than version 1 was, but we still have to make sure that this thing is good enough that mm-hmm. people aren't just going to pick it up and be like, man, what the hell were you guys thinking? This is a piece of crap.
Right.
So once again, our concept here is we are trying to create a post-nuclear game. Mm-hmm. We are trying to create this for public consumption, so we're going to balance it accordingly. And something else that we're going to try to do with this, post-nuke, I realize, has a lot of feels. That post-nuke, but magic came back. Post-nuke, but there's mutants and cyborgs everywhere.
Post-nuke that's ultra-militaristic, and it's a ROLL playing game.
Right. What we are going for in this is a strong ROLE, role-playing game. Mm-hmm. We want to create a lot of room for characters, a lot of sense about introspection, a strongly emotive game. Because this is a game that is just as much about hope as it is about the suffering and loss created by the nuclear war. I want it to be fairly realistic. I don't have a PhD in nuclear physics, and I accept that. Mm-hmm. I've done a little research with FEMA and also with some of the other government agencies like the Canadian one, the British one, to look at some of their material on nuclear wars. So we're going to try and make this fairly realistic. There are not going to be fish people mutants. There are not going to be laser machine gun cyborgs.
I don't want to play.
We are also going to try and make this game to have a strong survival element.
Right.
That we don't want to bog you guys down with little details of your personal biology, but we are going to include enough rules about things like disease and injury and such to try and give this the sense that you are not a bunch of hit points wandering around the desert.
Right.
You are a real person trying to survive off of the wreckage of society.
And again, it's all about balance. We want, and you know what? The team that's making this, or has made this in the past, it's a pretty balanced one. It's like on one hand you have Dan the simulationist, on the other hand you have me the storyteller. And hopefully those ideas and those concepts don't come together in a car wreck, but they come together more of an, they balance the scales. And call us on that if they don't.
I will.
I hope so.
All right, let's dig now into our next topic. So let's say you've got your conceptualization down. We just gave ours, our game concept right there. The next thing up is a little bit about gaming math. Now, we're not going to dig huge and deep into gaming math, but we're going to have to get a little bit technical here. I apologize for that, but it's math. You can't not
right.
get technical with it.
SOG is based on the monostat system. No. There, you wanted to hear it. It's out. Let's
I'm
get
just
out
glad
of
we're starting here because this is going to lay the framework for how I kill things. I can't wait to kill things in this game. Kill post-nuke things.
You know, I
don't even
like,
care what they
minute,
are.
Wait a minute, wait a minute.
Just want to start killing.
I realize why you don't want to play this game. Because I said there was no anthropomorphic mutants.
Well, maybe there are now.
There are no aardvark women out there to chase around.
He can't be an aardvark
woman. I can't
woman.
Start killing
well,
fast
also
enough.
Told him no laser machine guns.
Well, yeah, but the laser machine gun doesn't...
The laser machine is not an aardvark.
What the hell is a laser machine gun? That's two totally different concepts.
I don't know. A laser machine gun.
It's the laser pulses.
Oh, it's a machine gun that shoots laser guns.
No, I got it.
And ejects brass.
Yeah,
yes.
No. It has a clip, but instead of bullets, it's batteries.
Oh, you did not.
And then it ejects each battery as it spins the power of them.
Come on, can we please get back to
yeah,
the framework
of killing?
Yeah,
this is a Star Wars movie, by the way.
Whoa.
laser artillery, however that works exactly.
Well, are you talking about large laser cannons don't have recoil?
Yeah, and
make
shell,
sounds
expendable
and
shells and
yeah.
Anyway, our little rant there. All right, math. I realize math is not the most exciting topic, but once again, it is an important part of the game because a role-playing game really is the combination of two things: storytelling and simulation. And everyone who plays a role-playing game has both of those elements in there to some degree.
Yep.
Even someone doing the Box Canyon dungeon crawl does have some sort of story continuity to it, yeah. as weak as it may
and
be.
And even somebody who does the, you know, total role-playing LARP. Occasionally, you even see him do the paper, rock, scissors thing.
Right, to make some kind of decision. So yep. there, these two things are in there. The role of math within a role-playing game, and I want to talk about that, because the kind of math you choose to use and how you're going to set up the dice, it really needs to reflect what the math is supposed to do in the game. Okay, in the simplest terms, the math is supposed to simulate. So the question is, what is it trying to simulate and how is it trying to simulate it? Let me give you an example from video games. If you wanted a game, let's take the old X-Wing games.
Yes, in those, let's.
In the old X-Wing games, you flew as if you were in an atmosphere.
Right.
You had, when you turned, you immediately turned. You didn't keep going the original direction now facing
you
up.
And stuff.
If you shut off your thrusters, you slowed down to a stop as if you were facing air resistance. Well, the reason for this is the game was not meant to simulate ultra-realistic spaceflight.
It was made to be accessible.
It was made to be accessible.
It was made to be fun.
And it was made to simulate the Star Wars movies. Now, we can take other games out there that have far more realistic spaceflight because that's what they set it out to simulate. When you play a role-playing game, every role-playing game has some central kind of decision-making tool. All right. For example, when you're playing D&D, which is currently on the D20 system, every time you are going to attempt anything, you're going to hit the monster, you're going to heal the fallen guy, you're going to try and convince the prince of the town to help you, you are rolling a 20-sided die. The main decision maker of this game is 1d20. Okay, this is a 1dx game. It is done with one die. Let's take Battletech, for example. In Battletech, if you're going to shoot your gun, convince the prince to help you, heal the guy who fell, you're rolling 2 6-sided dice, 2d6. So Battletech is a 2dx game. And one of the first decisions you have to make about the math of your game, once again, within context of the feel, is what is your primary decision maker going to be? So at that, Tex, let me pass it to you for 1DX versus 2DX.
Well, there's two major differences there. With a 1DX system, the chance of any individual outcome is the same. So if you roll a 20-sided die, there's a 5% chance that any one of those numbers is going to come up. So your chance of getting a 3 or a 5 or a 10 is exactly equal to your chance of getting a 20. Now, with multi-die systems, for example, 2d6 or 3d6, the numbers tend to clump in the middle. So on a 2d6 system, your chances of rolling a 7 are far higher than your chances of rolling a 2 or a 12.
Right.
The advantage of this for simulation-type games is the rolls tend to be self-normalizing, because if you want the rolls to tend to average themselves out, if you throw 2d6 or 3d6, those results are going to tend to clump in the middle, and more often than not, you're going to get an average result. And your extreme results of, you know, a very low number or a very high number are going to be rare. With a 1DX system, your chances of getting a 1 or a 20 are exactly equal to your chances of getting a 10.
I think they made a great decision putting Star Wars on the D20 system where they were 1D20. Because if you look at Star Wars, for every average thing they did, they were just as likely to botch the hyperdrive or flip through a crowd of people cutting off hands and legs with a lightsaber.
Well, it definitely adds an element of unpredictability. Of course, with any time you roll dice, there's going to be unpredictability.
Some unpredictability.
But on a 1DX system, like a D20 system, there is a higher degree of unpredictable results. There's a much greater chance of getting an extreme success or an extreme failure.
Right. And we're actually going to put a graph of this up on the resources section, so that way, for those of you that are bored by math, we can move on. For those of you that are not bored by math, you can actually see where we're...
I'm just going to assume just because I understand how this works, that this is going to be a 2DX game.
Yes, this is definitely going to be a 2DX
game. Simply because I don't think Chad would have cared, and your preferred is the 2DX.
Yes, and the reason, because, once again...
Yeah, pretty much.
I know how this works.
Let's take 2D6, okay, as an example. If you look at 2D6 and chart out the possible rolls on 2D6, you only have a 1 in 36 chance of getting a 2 or a 12, the best and worst possible rolls. Yet you have a 1 in 6 chance, or a 6 in 36 chance, of getting a 7, which is your middle number.
Well, and you have a 16 in 36 chance of rolling one of the three middle numbers, a 6, 7, or an 8.
Right.
Which is why, for example, in Battletech, 6, 7, and 8 were the torso hit locations.
And in the case of Skies of Glass, we want a fairly realistic, gritty system. So therefore, we are opting for a 2DX system. Now, for anyone that really cares, we'll put a chart up of this. We won't go too deep. If you take a 3DX or a 4DX system, the more dice you add, the bigger the curve gets towards the middle. The harder it is to hit one of the ends, the easier it is to do average.
Right. With a 3D6 system, you actually begin to clearly see the bell curve. Because with 3D6, there's actually 216 possible outcomes of the roll. So the more dice you add, the more the bell curve clumps to the middle.
But we are going to avoid using tons of dice when we can, simply for personal choice. on a typical roll, I don't want to have people having to add up tons of different numbers in front of them. It just bogs down the game.
Well, there's also an element of speed. I mean, for example, if you were playing a game where your mighty heroes were going to crest the hill and below them was going to be 30 goblins that were going to attack them, rolling 2d6 or 3d6 30 times would be very tedious. Where with a 1DX system, you could just grab a fistful of dice, throw them all, real quick group the successes and failures, and you know how the goblins did.
Let me ask you guys this question, too, from the non-math person here. How do you guys feel about systems that try to use every single dice in the bowl, like an Alternity or maybe even old D&D systems?
Well, in the case of this game, I'm going to try and keep the dice pretty minimal, because I just want to make the game as accessible as possible. Now, having said that, I don't necessarily have any problem with a game that uses that many decision makers, provided that it's reasonable.
There's a point
to it. They're not just doing it for the sake of including every die to be neat.
That's kind of how I felt about Alternative.
Right. I know some gaming systems that we've played did that with combat, that some of the guns would have, you know, 1d4 or 1d6 or 1d10 modifiers to them.
D&D, for example, does do that.
But it does with a point, though.
Right, I agree. In D&D, I don't have a problem with it.
Smaller weapons use, like, smaller dice.
I think if I had to give a summary answer to Chad's question, the mathematical substructure exists to support your vision of how the game should play. It is the servant, not the master.
You should select
a mathematical subsystem that achieves how you want the gameplay to go, not vice versa. I don't think you should start with the math and then make a game around that. That would be very silly.
I completely 100% agree with you. If you are starting with a math idea or character sheet and you're trying to build a game around it, I'm not saying you will fail, but I am saying you're on dangerous ground already. Similarly, if you just try and grab a setting and then grab some system and just stuff the two together, if they are not made to fit each other's feel, you are also on dangerous ground, because this math should reflect the feel of that setting. Let's talk about criticals. We're talking about rolling dice, so let's talk about criticals. For those of you that have not heard of criticals, because either you're new to role-playing or have not played a game that has criticals in it, what a critical is it's the assumption that effectively you have really four different ways of things turning out. So we're doing surgery on somebody. We can fail. Okay, that means we botched the surgery. We do not succeed at what it is we're trying to do here. Person's still alive. We just didn't succeed at the surgery. Success, we got in there. We did what we needed to do. The guy's going to live. Now, at the far ends of that, you can say there may also be a critical failure. While we were going in there to do a simple procedure, we stabbed the guy in a major artery and just killed him on the table. Or a critical success.
Now he's Superman. Flying around the city solving crime.
Or a critical success, we go in there and this
bleeding man.
This turns out perfect. This surgery has a recovery time of 10 days. He's going to be out of the hospital in 3. And on top of that, we found another problem he didn't even know about and fixed that too.
Gave him laser beam eyes.
You want to put this in terms of shooting? You've got a target set up. Success, you hit the target. Failure, you miss the target. Critical success, you bounce it off a wall and then put it straight through the bullseye. Critical failure, you shoot the guy next to you.
Behind you.
Because he looks strangely like a target.
Well, and you need to ask yourself two questions in your game design. First, do you want to allow for critical events?
Big first question. Do you even want to allow these things?
Do you want to have a spectacular success or a spectacular failure? And then the second question.
Something like D&D. Wants to have the spectacular successes and the spectacular fails. It's a heroic game. That's why they use a D20.
Right. And the second question you want to ask yourself is, how common do you want them to be? For example, there are 2DX games which have critical successes and critical failures, but because they're on a 2DX system, these criticals, for example, the headshot or the center torso critical, are extremely rare. Where on a 1DX system, these unusual events or these critical events are going to be more common.
For our game, I will be using critical successes and failures.
Yay.
Just because I like the sense of kind of wildness it adds to it, that someone can stumble in on beginner's luck and do amazing things, just as the old grizzled veteran can have those days where it's just not with him and he screws up.
Where grandma kicked his ass.
So we will be using critical successes and failures in this game. Let's talk about level of complexity. When you sit down and make a role-playing game, and this is one of those things, you cannot necessarily cook to everyone's taste because everyone has different tastes. There are people out there that prefer amber diceless. and there are people out there that prefer hero systems, and there's everything in between. You have to decide, though, when you sit down, what level of complexity you want to put into your game. If you create tons of rules and tons of charts, then you get, really, assuming you did them well, more realism and more information for the players to work with to support this game. But it also slows things down because you have more to memorize, more to learn, more to look up. For example, in D&D, when you hit someone with a sword, it's real easy. You just take off a certain number of their hit points and go down. But if you want to throw in things like hit locations and individual wound types and such, that complexity goes up. And so you have to decide coming into this what sort of complexity you want to put on the game. And Tex, something you mentioned that also figures into this is the intended scale of the game. That this is the kind of game that's really meant to focus on two or three people wandering around doing relatively limited things. You can add a level of complexity you just can't get away with in a game where you foresee the party being 15 people who are taking on 30 goblins at a time. One battle is going to take all week to do.
Oh, that's, then it's time to abstract and use percentile die. 15% of the goblins hit.
Well,
I'm sorry.
I agree with you.
2d10.
I agree.
15% of the goblins hit.
I agree with you completely, but GMing shortcuts is not what the series is about. So we're assuming you're writing rules that are meant to be used, not shortcut. I want to talk about something else, and these are terms that I have invented, so I'm going to use them and then define them. You have to decide whether you want an additive system or a subtractive system. Okay, what do I mean by that? The fastest Star Trek, for example, is a subtractive system. Let's say you have a strength of 75, and you roll percentile dice, and you roll a 40. Well, if someone wanted to know how much you succeed by, they would take 75 minus 40. Your success can be determined as being 35, okay? So you succeeded 35%, whatever that means, which probably means you did pretty well. In an additive system, let's take the D20 system. This is an additive system. I have, let's say, a strength bonus of +3. I roll a D20, add my +3 to it, add some situational modifiers, and based on that, my success number goes up. So if I say I have a total of a 25 in the D20 system, that's a pretty good success. So you're working your way upward. Now, what's the difference between the two systems? This is not just cosmetic. The problem with a subtractive system like Star Trek is a subtractive system does not scale very well. For example, let's say you have someone that has a 120 strength. Well, how do they fail on percentile dice? They can't, because they will always roll under their 120. The worst you can roll on percentile dice is 100. Well, you can say, all right, well, cheap way out. We'll just say that we'll take critical failures. 100 is always a failure. Well, then what if the guy next to him has a 300 strength or 3,000 strength? Well, suddenly they all have the same chance of failure, 1%. The guy with 3,000 strength, the guy with 120 strength.
Anybody can get a herniated disc.
Well, I agree.
You got to lift properly.
Well, additive systems are far, far more common. Subtractive systems are typically only used in very strong simulationist environments with a narrow scope of characters and non-player characters.
The key phrase there is narrow scope. A subtractive system works great when all you intend to deal with in the system is relative equals. In Star Trek, the subtractive system works great because what are you dealing with? You're a humanoid, you're taking on other humanoids. You really don't have situations in Star Trek where people are firing phasers at giant robots or people are brawling with tanks. It's always some humanoid of some size versus another humanoid who may be a little tougher, a little less tough, but who's basically in your league that you are taking on. Something like D&D, you simply cannot put a human and a gigantic elder worm on the same 1-100 scale. You will never be able to do it. So an additive system works much better because you just allow them to keep adding more to the number and working your way up instead of working your way down.
Although one warning there with an additive system, try to limit how much you're adding in relative to the range of the die. For example, with the D20, you're going to have a range of possibilities of 1 to 20. You don't want to get into an additive system where you're adding 3 and 400 because then the variance that the dice adds
means
is
nothing.
Very, very small.
Right.
So I would suggest maybe limiting yourself to adding at most double the maximum value of the die to still allow the die to have some meaningful randomness.
Yeah, he's right, because if you have on a regular basis guys with a +500 bonus of strength, what does the D20 roll really mean anymore? It decides whether I got a 501 or a 520. it becomes pointless. And I believe in D&D, you look at some of the big dragons and such, and even the larger creatures don't typically go beyond more than about a plus 20 or plus 30 to their rolls.
Right, and most characters are going to have maybe a base modifier, but most plus 4.
Yeah, and you eventually get to plus 5s and such, but yeah, you're talking relatively small numbers. Oh, I should probably explain what we're doing with our game. With our game, we are going to use an additive system. The reason being, even though we are primarily focusing on the people that are out there, we do want to allow for direct interaction with things like vehicles, and also we're going to be introducing some genetically engineered creatures that are now wandering the world as if they were wild creatures. And because we want to put those in direct interaction with the players, we are therefore going to use an additive system, so you can pretty quickly figure out what happens when one guy comes face to face with some genetically engineered mega creature, which we'll get into those later on.
Let me ask you this. Where should a person start? Again, say they're sitting here, they're listening to this, they're ready to design their game. Should they, and they have their concept, should they start with the rules system? Because that's what we're starting with, and that's what people are going
to
think.
I don't think you have to know. We want to talk about math here, but this was, in our case, more of just a show production choice to talk about the two high levels at once. Because in our game, we're designing both setting and rules. So we're talking kind of like, where do you begin with setting? And we talk about setting your objectives and just determining what you want to do with it and making sure it's developable and something you love. And now we're talking about, where do you begin with the rules? Well, now that you've got a base setting, you can look at the rules and say, hey, do I want grit or heroism? 1DX versus 2DX. Do I want a quick playing game or a more realistic game? Well, that's where you set your slider between simple and complex. Do you want the game to have sort of a wild feel to it? Well, there's your criticals. Do you want the game to scale, or does it even need to scale? There's additive versus subtractive. Now, do you have to move from your base concept of setting to the math? No. However, I do think setting has to come before rules. I think rules must be the servant of setting. But you could skip from your game concept to the whole big series we're going to do on world design and technology and backstory and history and all that stuff, and then come back to math completely separately.
Okay.
This was just a production choice, really, for this show. But that's a good question.
And we have the computer engineering math major.
Yeah, we have Tex in town, so we wanted to use his unique skills while he was present.
Another thing you could do too early in the design phase, once you have some simple rules hashed out, is play out a couple of quick battles and see if they play as quickly or as slowly as you think they should play, and see if you think they're as predictable or wacky as you feel they should be.
And even more importantly, put these rules in the hands of strangers.
Yep.
Because you are going to play the game a certain way because it's what you had in mind. They are going to play it a completely different way.
You know that power gamer friend you've got? Give him the rules.
Yeah, that's see what right. he does with them.
The rules lawyer that you hate and you don't game with anymore.
He's now your best friend.
Hey, that's Phil, right. We got a game for you to run.
All right, well, thank you guys very much for tuning in. Be sure to send us in your entries for the Xbox thing at feartheboot.com/contest, or just click the contest link at the top of the site. We will give away one of those on the next podcast, and we will start the next contest then. So,
excellent.
Catch you guys then.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot. This show is copyright 2006, fully owned by its hosts. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in this show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.